zone. Also, look at that rainbow peace sign. So you might want to take your rainbow and turn it green. The green party is here.
Okay, we're on live with Captain Fred of Berkeley Liberation Radio. Captain Fred, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. How's it going?
Oh, good. How you doing? But we're on here again. It was less than 2 months ago. We were here and talking about Berkeley Liberation Radio evicted as of June 30th. That still stands, but now apparently there's a notice of illegal broadcasting. Why don't you tell us some of the details about that?
Okay, agents from the FCC have been by our studio 2 times this month, delivering basically a cease and desist order. The first one was on the 15th, and I believe the second one was about a week later, approximately.
What does the notice say?
Well, basically saying we observed that you guys were broadcasting at 104.1 FM, and by the way, you need a license to do that, and you better cut it out.
So they've noticed. They've noticed recently. This broadcasting's been going on for a while. So when they give those notices, do they give you any indication of why they're giving the notice, or is it just simply that there's no license, you can't broadcast?
Well, there are little boxes on the form that they can check off that indicate, you know, whether or not spurious signals were noticed or this, that, or the other thing about the signal, you know, technical details. But, you know, it's a pretty standard form. They call a notice of apparent liability.
What's the liability?
The liability is that they don't want you to do it.
Okay. Did they say whether there's complaints about interference? Because a lot of times in the past, you know, the FCC doesn't really tell people what they're doing. I'm just trying to glean as much of what's come out technically as I can. They don't tell people what they're doing, but sometimes they cite complaints about interference. Does that seem like the case this time?
Well, the first notice they gave us did not have any of the little boxes checked. The second notice they gave us indicated that we were interfering with aircraft communications.
Okay. And the gist of the notice, it was a 10-day notice, right? And what has to happen in 10 days?
Well, what they want is they want a written response to the notice in 10 days.
Okay. Is that happening?
There has been a response written by our lawyer and sent off to them.
I have in other stations in the past, I know San Francisco Liberation Radio as an example. I'm not even sure they've responded to the written notices. So I know those are the formalities, but the gist of it is get off the air or else. What is the or else? What's implied if stations don't just comply and back off?
Well, at the bottom of the form, it indicates that failure to comply could involve penalties of $100,000 or a year in prison or both.
Okay.
That is the threat.
Right. Okay. Are there any plans of what you might want to admit publicly about how Berkeley Liberation Radio is going to deal with this?
Well, the first thing we want to do is find a new home. The second thing we want to do is create a presence on the World Wide Web as a web stream station.
And what will that do?
That will keep our little movement alive. And then the third thing we want to do is hope that somebody might pick up our web stream and rebroadcast it on the air for regular folks who aren't hooked up to the internet.
So it sounds like it does a few things. It keeps the station in touch with some of its listeners. It allows people outside of the listening areas to listen. And sounds like if radio stations out there want to play the stream, then there might be some radio.
Right. We were hoping to make an arrangement with the folks at Enemy Combatant Radio, and they were basically offering to let us use the broadcast facility that they had. But as it turns out, they got a notice about the same time we did, so that's probably not going to happen now.
Okay. I don't think that's Enemy Combatant Radio, but I think you're talking about 104.9 FM
right
in the East Bay. So there were two notices to the two micro radio stations out there within a week's time. Looking more broadly at it, what do people within the station speculate, if anything, about the timing of this, about two notices coming at once? What's the sense that people have in the station about what's going on here, and what's the mood of people involved in terms of, you know, not your technical response, but how people feel about what's going on and what broadcasters want to do?
Mm-hmm. Well, the emotional response to this little inconvenience in our life is that people are very stressed out. And there's been a lot of speculation about, you know, conspiracy theories and suspicions about various people, and even, you know, outright accusations of people either inside or outside the group that they were somehow involved in cooperating with the FCC or whatever. But I would say, you know, the main thing is just people are stressed right now.
Talk more about that. Because that touches on a key point that listeners might not really hear, but how, you know, the FCC hovering over these stations really, really negatively affects people's ability to broadcast, people's ability to work together, people's ability to go out in public and promote their station, publicize it, organize around it. That just one of these notices, it's similar to anything that a radical activist group's going to have to deal with when they start getting infiltrated. But how does this affect radio? It's the FCC is supposed to be promoting a policy of micro radio, but you know, it sounds like this is totally different. Every station I hear from, as soon as there's a legal action, there is a lot of distress, and sometimes that's all the FCC needs to, you know, to win in the situation is just flex the muscle.
Yeah, well, about 95% of your stations, when they get that first letter from the FCC, they turn very compliant and they turn off their transmitter and they go quiet immediately. We, on the other hand, are a little bit more hard-headed and sort of like we're inspired by the granddaddy of Micropower Radio, Mbana Kintako, who basically will never back down, and no matter how much pressure is put on him or repression, he keeps coming back on the air with whatever means he can, and has been doing so for decades now.
Great. Do you have much information on what Free Radio Santa Cruz is doing? They had a similar raid, and our last interview you mentioned that they're back on the air. What has their strategy been for getting back up and broadcasting?
Well, basically the first thing they did was they set up a web stream on their website, which is freakradio.org, and then parties unrelated to the radio station are picking up that web stream and broadcasting it in the Santa Cruz area at 101.1 FM. So basically, in effect, they are on the air, even though nobody from the station is involved with the on-air broadcast, and you know there's no way to connect the two. Still, they are, you know, they can be heard by the people who like them down there, and they have a lot of people who really appreciate what they're doing. So that's how they survive now as a web station.
Okay, so they broadcast on the web, and as far as the radio is concerned, some unrelated party is picking them up. Has that been, has that type of thing run into FCC action? I think that's kind of a newer technology. Has that strategy worked for stations or come to a head, or is it kind of a brand new station strategy that's been untested of just getting the stuff up on the web and seeing who can put it on the radio?
Right. Well, in the old days, there were what they called studio-to-transmitter links, or STLs, where basically folks would use a UHF radio frequency at a low power to send a small signal from their studio to their transmitter and then rebroadcast on the broadcast frequency from their transmitter site. The current model was, you know, first started in Seattle with what they called the Mosquito Net, where basically they have Radio X, which operates from the Indy Media Center, and then around town, almost like a cell phone network, there are a series of small 5-watt FM stations that are hooked up to computers and the internet who pick up the web stream from Radio X and broadcast it in the Seattle area. And if, you know, if one particular node gets served notice, they can close it down, move it to another place, whatever. That's how they survive in Seattle, and that's been a good working example of how other stations could keep going, you know, despite FCC.
Okay, great. Before we wrap up, talk about the state of radio in a broader sense and, you know, the state of what the FCC is actually controlling. It's more like not any kind of public interest. It's more the interest of a big oligopoly with a few radio stations. So what's your take on radio, you know, the whole thing, you know, with a few micro radio stations out there in the world and a bunch of corporate stations and not much else on there?
Yeah, well, I publish a newsletter called the AMPB Report, and in the last issue I put out, I was pointing out that we're sort of at a fork in the road, and down one path you have the digital radio, the IBOC, the in-band on-channel radio. You have folks like Clear Channel who own over 1,000 radio stations. You have the satellite radio, and basically what it does is it gets more technological, it gets more complicated, and it gets more concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people. And also, I mean, what do they expect everybody to throw out their analog radios and go out and get digital radios or what they call HD radio? I don't think that's very smart. First of all, people cannot even hear any appreciable improvement in sound quality between a digital FM and just regular good old analog FM. So the whole bugaboo that, you know, the argument was, oh, you're going to have digital quality sound and it's going to be wonderful. Bull. Well, you know, down the other path is, you know, more diverse programming on smaller stations. There's no need to have these 500,000-watt, 1,000,000-watt stations that blanket, you know, 100 square miles, things like that. You know, first of all, the stuff is a health risk, and secondly, it, you know, it just feeds into the whole bull argument about spectrum scarcity and how there's no space on the dial for community radio. There's plenty of room for community radio on the dial, even in urban areas, and we have proved it here in Berkeley for years, that people can coexist on a two-channel spacing, or even one channel. If they're operating at low power, they can be on single adjacent channels and not interfere with each other. So, I mean, you know, my whole point is we've got to get on the right track and, you know, get away from this huge concentration of media power.
So you're saying there's actually more there. You look at the radio, there's a lot of talk about how 10 corporations own about two-thirds of the spectrum. Clear Channel and Viacom are way up there in the 40%. But worse than that, when you get from below 92 down to 87, the left end of the FM dial, which was supposed to be left for non-commercial broadcasts, it's almost all NPR now, government radio funded and micromanaged by the government's Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We still do have a few college radio stations here that mostly specialize in good independent alternative music, but you go around the country and it's mostly that whole end of the dial is about three or four NPR stations sometimes that are playing things at the same time. But you're saying that even short of the FCC distributing licenses more effectively, that stations could come on right next to each other? They seem to already here. In other words, that if one station's on 89.7, another station can get on 89.9, a micro station, and another one could get on 90.1, and they're not going to interfere with each other?
Exactly. That's my whole point. And in fact, one of the things we were lobbying for, since the FCC was reassigning all the TV stations new frequencies for their digital broadcast, which is, you know, the same sort of bull that we're dealing with the digital radio, we were saying that we thought that the space on the FM dial, just below the current FM dial, say between 85 and 88 megahertz, would be best served as a community radio or micropower radio area. And that, you know, Japan already manufactures FM radios that go down below 88 megahertz. So it would be, you know, not that hard for people to get their hands on these radios. And you could have them right next to each other on the dial, micro stations at, you know, 85.1, 85.2, 85.3, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no reason why these micro stations couldn't exist, and there's no reason why a metro area like the San Francisco Bay Area couldn't have 100 micro stations. But the FCC doesn't see it as in their interest, and the broadcast industry, the NAB, does not see it in their interest because, well, they'd be losing ratings and listeners, and less, and they'd be making less money. So it's all, you know, bottom line is money. And I will say that NPR, so-called national public radio, is anything but public because the public has nothing to do with it except being passive consumers of what should better be called national propaganda radio.
Or national government radio,
or
straight out, right?
Or they call it national petroleum radio because it was oil companies bankrolling the NPR.
Or truthfully, so, just government radio, right? If we were in a totalitarian country, that's what they do. Just
one of the first things the Nazi Party did was go around and round up all the radios and replace them with radios that could only pick up the Nazi broadcasts, and then that by controlling access to information, they were able to brainwash the citizens of Germany, and then shortly after that, they came around and rounded up the guns, and then they march them off to the camps, and then, you know, that's where we're headed with all this.
Yeah, that's about where we're at. So it sounds like with the FCC, they've got oligopoly, monopolistic conditions. And what you talk about in economic terms is called artificial scarcity, where the powers that be artificially limit the supply so that a few players can take it over. That's absolutely all it is. What can listeners do to support the station, and where can listeners go to keep abreast on how to find Berkeley Liberation Radio once once the station's off the air?
Okay, we're going to be communicating via email with folks. If you want to keep in touch with Berkeley Liberation Radio and find out what we're up to, send an email to berkeleyliberationradio@yahoo.com, and we'll be putting together an email list and, you know, updating folks. And keep your ear to the ground. Good. We find the broadcast media not so supportive, but we have found the print media, especially the alternative press, to be very supportive. So Bay Guardian will keep you updated. Also, Berkeley Daily Planet will keep you updated. And, you know, be sure to surf by 104.1 FM on the dial, because we're not about to give up.
Great. There's a press conference coming up?
Right. And Monday, June 27th at 4 o'clock p.m. will be the temporarily off-the-air time for Berkeley Liberation Radio. So we're going to have a press conference and a party, and we're going to literally pull the plug on the radio station at 4 o'clock Monday. And since it's no longer a secret to the FCC, I'll just feel free to announce, everybody come on by, 5427 Telegraph Avenue, Suite W3, and meet the pirates and, you know, have a beer with us, all right?
Okay, great. Anything else you want to say?
Well, what I always tell people is that we're like mushrooms. We're kept dark, kept in the dark and fed bullshit.
There you go. And they're not going to keep Captain Fred's World Cruise landlocked for very long?
No, the World Cruise sails out again on July 15.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks for calling. Hang on the line for a minute.
All righty.
Okay, we're going to get some music going here really quickly.
What's your favorite number?
One. Bye.